on RNIB Connect Radio.
Right beginning to today's happy hour. That was, of course, ABBA with Ring, Ring. Welcome to today's show. Once again, Holly and Paulina here, keeping you company for the next hour.
Yes, we'll be bringing you lots of chat about sight loss, well-being, and things that help us stay happy.
On today's show, we'll be joined by a professional blind woodturner who will share his story. And we'll also have a lovely book recommendation.
And very shortly, I'll be hearing from one lady who will speak to us about her personal story of a sight loss.
That's coming up in a moment after Mike and the Mechanics.
Looking back over my shoulder, I can see that look in your eyes. My heart.
You're listening to The Happy Hour on RNIB Connect Radio. Receiving a sight loss diagnosis is never easy, but having the right kind of support to build your confidence and look after your well-being could make all the difference. So joining me today to share her own experience of being diagnosed later in life and why it's so essential to provide that emotional support is Lucille Franks. It is lovely speaking with you again, Lucille.
Hello there. Yes, nice to be here again.
So would you mind telling us a little bit about your story, because you were diagnosed a little bit later in life?
Yeah, I was diagnosed with retinitis pigmentosa in my 40s. I didn't really start noticing a major issue with my eyesight until I was in my 30s. And I did get referred to the hospital and they told me there was something going on with my retina, but I wasn't really properly diagnosed until I was in my 40s.
What emotions were you going through at the time? Because you were diagnosed, as you said, in your 40s. What were your first, I guess, your first response to the diagnosis and finding out that your sight will deteriorate further over time?
Well, for many, the first response, even though it wasn't for a very long time, was actually relief. I think sometimes having a diagnosis can be a relief. And, you know, it wasn't that I was overreacting. It wasn't that I was clumsy. There was a reason for what was happening and the struggles. That didn't last long. I can remember I actually caught the bus home. And I can remember just sort of sitting down on the bus and almost just bursting into tears because this thought suddenly came into my head, will I see my children get married? Which seems a bit of a random thing and perhaps not the thing you should be most worried about, but it's just what came into my head. And then I got quite upset about it.
It's a valid reaction. It's your own reaction. And, you know, thinking about those important moments that you have in the future and how it's going to impact your life and your loved one's life is completely understandable. So It was quite an emotional time for you. Did you receive any support at the time?
At the time, not really from the hospital. The gentleman that gave me the diagnosis was actually quite good. He wrote down the diagnosis because I was like, how on earth do you spell that? And said to me, look, you know, if you're going to look it up on the internet, that's fine, but please be careful where you look, stick to NHS. He actually mentioned RP Fighting Blindness, who are now Retina UK. So he mentioned them and Moorfields Eye Hospital. I knew nothing about any of these things. So I did take on board what he said and was very careful at what I looked at on the internet.
So did you have to look for your own support and for your own support network? Is that what happened?
Very much, yeah. I mean, nowadays they've got these fantastic people in some places called ECLOs, Eye Clinic Liaison Officers, and they're just brilliant and they just need to be everywhere as far as I'm concerned. But I don't think that existed at the time. Certainly wasn't something I was aware of at the time. And I did have to do my own research. And I'm hugely, hugely thankful for where I live because I knew Kent Association for the Blind. I knew where they were. And I literally just turned up on their doorstep and said, I need help.
So where did you go from there? You finally, you got the courage up to ask for help. And what happened? Like, what, take us through those steps, through those first, I guess, initial period of your diagnosis.
So I suppose the first big step was actually going to Moorfields Eye Hospital. I had all sorts of weird and wonderful tests done. And although it wasn't pleasant, I guess it was the first time I felt the diagnosis was being taken seriously and someone professional was taking it seriously. And therefore I could say to people, no, I have this. I'm not just clumsy. I'm not just making a fuss. This is what I have. And it is, you know, a serious condition. And then, yeah, as I said, I went to Kent Association for the Blind. They were fantastic. they sort of, I suppose, help me with more the practical side. They do assessments for the local authority and give whatever help is available through the local authority. They encouraged me to get registered and they keep the register for my council. Then I spoke to what would now be the Retina UK helpline, who are just the best. They're just so good. And they were so, you know, they really understood what I was going through and helped me realise that this may be rare, but there were lots of other people and what I was going through was very normal. Finally, plucked up the courage after talking to some people at a Retina UK conference about a cane, plucked up the courage to go, look into cane training. And that's when I really started to feel better about the whole thing and started to feel able to do things that I'd been really struggling to do.
Because I think that's what often happens when you get this initial diagnosis. You don't really know much what it is. And then your next steps are really about getting your confidence and your life and your well-being back in order.
Yeah, you know, working out what the new normal is really for you. And that's one of the issues with gradual sight loss is your new normal keeps changing. And, you know, your eyesight deteriorates and suddenly something can't be done the way that you've been doing it and you need to find a new way to do it or stop doing it, whatever. If there's something I really want to do, pretty much always I can find a way to do it. But there are some things I let go because I go, do you know what? I'm not actually worried about being able to do that thing and I'm struggling to do it. So someone else is going to do it now or I'm just not going to do that anymore and I'm going to find something else. And you go through that sort of cycle more than once, and that's really quite hard, I find.
So it's a constant cycle of adapting and changing your life and adapting to what's happening. How are you feeling these days?
I'm doing okay considering everything that's going on in the world and, you know, all the other challenges that everyone is facing. My main problem at the moment is I also have cataracts now, and unfortunately I've been waiting 3 years to have them operated on. So my eyesight at the moment literally changes monthly. And that's obviously a big challenge. You know, when your eyesight is gradually deteriorating, you do have periods where things seem to, you know, be the same. And with RP, that can be, you know, that can be years that it's quite stable and things stay very much the same. But yeah, when your eyesight is changing monthly and I suppose in a way unnecessarily, that I find really tough. Yeah.
But despite all of this and despite everything that's happening in your life and obviously having to wait for the cataract surgery, you are somehow managing to stay quite positive because I heard you set up a Twitter account. You are working with Retina UK to around well-being and the importance of well-being. So would you mind telling us a little bit more about those two ventures?
Yeah, so for some time I'd wanted to set up a Twitter account. And I like to, I do post things when things go wrong, but I very much like to also post when things go right. So when you've had a good experience, when you've been anxious about doing something and it's gone well, when you've had a really excellent person on the train helping you out, when you've gone in a shop and they've been extremely helpful, all those things. I mean, in an ideal world, that would be the norm, but we're not living in that ideal world. And I just think it's really helpful to post positive things as well as posting when, you know, a van's parked in your way and you've had to go out in the road and things like that. I say it's about awareness. So I do post things when things go wrong for that. But it's also just trying to show a positive side to it as well. And then I've recently started volunteering again for Retina UK. One of the many things they're really trying to do is get as many local groups up as possible. So I'm helping them set up a group in Kent. But they're also doing a lot, like a lot of charities. They've realised the importance of well-being I think Retina UK probably realised it quite a long time ago, actually, and the importance of encouraging people to find ways of helping themselves, because counselling is great, but it can often be a long wait. And if you can show people things that can help themselves while they're waiting, or as well as the counselling, or after the counselling, then that's really good. And that's something I'm really quite passionate about, encouraging people to find what helps them to keep going.
No, I really liked what you said there, because I feel like we sometimes forget that happiness doesn't just show up at our doorstep. It's much like getting into a physical activity. You kind of have to work on your own well-being, and sometimes you have to work on your mental health and find these tactics and ways of staying happy and feeling better.
Yeah, and the problem with mental health is if your mental health isn't good, you don't want to do that, actually. You don't want to find ways to help yourself feel better necessarily.
It feels like pulling your teeth out, doesn't it?
Yeah. But I think if you can encourage someone to just take just one small step at a time to do something that helps them feel better, you know, the reality is it doesn't matter how much support you've got or haven't. You have got to look for it. Happiness isn't going to just turn up one day and be there forever. You know, you do need to do things for yourself. And I understand how hard that can be if your mental health is going through a bad patch. But that's the reality, I think, unfortunately.
Yeah, and sometimes even just understanding more what triggers our mental health and what behaviors are not good for us can be good, because we can almost create contingencies. So if you're maybe not feeling really well, you know, there's a couple things that you can do that, as hard as they're going to be to get up and do, they will make you feel better after you finish them. So could be exercise, could be making your bed.
Exactly. And I think that only comes with sort of experience of really thinking, you know, is this good for me? And just sort of remembering and going, okay, I know it doesn't matter how awful I feel. If I get to the gym, I will feel better. So what's the first step I need to do to take to the gym? That first step might be getting out of bed. It might be feeding yourself. It might be getting dressed. But that's how I do it. I'm quite a logical person, and I'm really thankful for that, actually, because I can think, okay, what will make me be better, and what's the first step I need to take to make myself better? But there are days when I just don't want to do that, thank you very much, and I'm quite happy feeling sorry for myself at home and watching telly. And actually, that's okay. It's not okay if it's all the time, but if you need, as I call it, a day off, I just say to my family, I'm having a day off, and that's what's happening, and that's the end of it. And they know, okay, mum needs, you know, time out, and she'll probably be fine tomorrow. But, you know, it's a tough one with mental health. There aren't any certain answers. You know, there's not one treatment.
It's very personal, and it's something that everyone needs to, I guess, work on themselves, hopefully with some support and help from others. So whilst we have you here on the Happy Hour, I would love to hear, me, if you have any advice for anyone who, like you, is maybe going through a degenerative eye condition like retinitis pigmentosa, and their reality changes and shifts so regularly. What would you say is the one thing that you maybe tell yourself whenever that happens, and whenever you're struggling a little bit?
I think it's really helpful to look back and say, yeah, I've had times like this before, and I have got through it. And I can get through it this time. But I also think it's important to allow yourself permission to go through the emotions that you need to go to.
Lucille, thank you so much for speaking with us today on the Happy Hour, for sharing your story, for giving your own words of wisdom. And hopefully we can speak again on the Happy Hour and catch up with what you're up to.
That would be lovely. Thank you.
I heard there was a secret chord that David played, and it pleased the Lord. But you don't really care for music, do ya? Well, it
goes like this, the fourth, the fifth, the minor fall and the major lift, the baffled king composing hallelujah, hallelujah, hallelujah. Strong, but you needed proof. You saw her bathing on the roof, her beauty and the moonlight over Fruya. She tied you to her kitchen chair. She broke your throne and she cut your hair. And from your lips she drew.
Alexandra Burke and her 2009 cover of Hallelujah. What a lovely rendition. You're listening to The Happy Hour with Holly and Paulina. I'm going through a bit of a reading slump at the minute and can't really get into any new books. I don't know, I'm just finding that I can't always concentrate or just not really getting into them. Maybe it's the weather. So I've been returning to some of my favourite books, but for a bit of inspiration, Paulina, what would you say are your favorite comfort reads?
Oh gosh, I don't often reread books, so I feel like it's a hard question, but like one of my favorite two books that I've read in the last few years would be The Night Circus, which is such a lovely story. It's so charming and it's so magical and it's all about love, and it's just I finished the book and I felt it gave like a really feel good end to a story, and I really enjoyed it. And then the other one was oh gosh, what is it called? It's The Seven Husbands of Evelyn Hugo from Taylor Jenkins Reid, which coincidentally we are going to get a review of one of her books, but not the one I really love. It's a different one. But she's a wonderful writer. Absolutely recommend her stuff. Really, really, really engaging and really easy to read in a day, like really quickly.
I feel like that's the kind of book I need at the minute, so I'm gonna definitely add that to my list for sure.
It just depends what you fancy. So if you want something magical and with a little bit of like charm and that feeling of like love and feeling quite wholesome when you finish it, Night Circus. If you want something which is like exciting and but exciting in a plot of like drama, then Seven Husbands of Evelyn Hugo is a great book, and it's inspired a lot by the classic kind of Hollywood bombshells. So do recommend it.
They both sound great. I feel like they're going to be really good for depending on what you want to read, if you're in different kinds of moods. I'm definitely going to check those out.
Yeah, and then, you know, if you're stuck, obviously there's the RNIB library, and they also on their website, they usually recommend some of the latest books. So they highlight a few. If you're not sure, you can always check them out as well.
Absolutely. I always head there for recommendations. They always give me some new and exciting reads. Okay, so those were Paulina's book recommendations, but now it's time for another. Here's Chris Wallace with his favourite read.
I said, give me something rock and roll. That felt like a win-win. And Billy said, how about this? I can't stand Daisy Jones.
Before I worked for RNIB Connect Radio, I was privileged enough to be part of the team who created RNIB Talking Books. As such, I gained an appreciation for audiobooks and an understanding of how important a single brilliant narrator or a team of exceptional narrators are to the enjoyment of the book. Daisy Jones and the Six by Taylor Jenkins Reid uses a cast of no less than 21 narrators, including Hollywood stars Jennifer Beals, Pablo Schreiber, Benjamin Bratt, and Judy Greer. A high-quality production such as this is nothing short of miraculous, and the multiple characters retelling the oral history of one of the biggest fictional bands of the 70s very much merits such an undertaking.
You know how sometimes people will describe other people and say they make you feel like you're the only one in the room? Billy and Daisy could both do that, but they somehow did it with each other. They each seemed like they thought the other one was the only person in the room, like we were watching two people who didn't realize thousands of people were watching them.
Billy was a great guitar player. There was an intricacy, a delicateness when he played.
At that slower tempo, the song started to seem even more intimate. It was gentler, it was softer, and I was sort of taken aback in that moment that Daisy could so easily go where I was taking us. If I played slower, she could bring a warmth to it. If I played faster, she'd bring the energy. She was so easy to be good with.
When we finished, he put the guitar in one hand and he grabbed my hand with the other. All the skin on the soft side of his fingers was calloused. Just by touching you, he'd scrape you.
The book tells the story of Daisy Jones, who comes of age in late 60s LA on the Sunset Strip and clubs like Whiskey A Go-Go. Her voice and carefree lifestyle are a perfect fit for the rock and roll music she loves. At the same time, the Six are a popular band on a downward slide as their charismatic leader, Billy Dunn, is going off the rails. A savvy record producer combines these two in a powder keg, leading to the type of rock music explosion that makes up the stuff of legend. If all of this sounds pretty familiar, it will be no surprise to hear that Daisy Jones and the Six is a fictional account of a group of musicians that draws heavily from the Titanic success and fall from grace of Fleetwood Mac.
She sang the entire song with such a heartbreaking lament. She made that song so much more than what I'd given her.
I opened my eyes after that take, and I barely remembered doing it. I just remember thinking, I did it. I remember realizing I had even more power in me than I had originally thought, that I had more to give, more depth and range than even I knew about myself.
She was looking right at Billy the whole time she sang, and he was staring at her, nodding along with her. When she finished the song, Teddy started clapping, and the look on her face, the delight she felt, it was like watching a kid on Christmas. Truly, she was so proud of herself. She pulled the headphones off and threw them down and ran out of the booth, and I kid you not, ran directly into Billy's arms. He picked her up just off the floor and kind of swung her back and forth for a moment, and I could have sworn to you, he smelled her hair before he put her back down.
This riveting and unforgettable novel captures a time, place, and an emotional fragility in women and men, all with an utterly distinctive voice. Taylor Jenkins Reid, as an author, has the ability to draw you in and leave you wrought. The talented narrators brilliantly convey the depth and subtleties of the writing. You'll love this book if you're a fan of a good rock and roll love story. Taylor Jenkins Reid does a fabulous job of making you feel like you're part of the era, whether in a bar on the Sunset Strip, on a tour bus, or on stage in front of a cheering crowd of fans. Some of the events felt so realistic I had to stop myself from looking up whether or not this fictional band was actually real. As with all great works of fiction, a TV show starring Riley Coe and Sam Coughlin is in the works, so there's never been a better time to get this book from the RNIB library and be a step ahead of your friends who will undoubtedly come to it within a few years. You might even fall in love with Daisy or Billy and their music along the way. You can access this book for free along with 32,000 other audiobooks by visiting readingservices.rnib.org.uk.
Thank you so much, Chris. I'll have to check that book out. Now, still to come on the Happy Hour, we'll be hearing from a blind wood turner. Chris will share his music therapy choice later, and of course, more great music just now.
You're looking kind of lonely, girl. Would you like someone new to talk to? Oh, yeah, alright. I'm feeling kind of lonely too, if you don't mind. Can I sit down here beside you? Oh, yeah, alright. If I seem to come on too strong, I hope that you will understand. I say these things 'cause I'd like to know if you're as lonely as I am, and if you'd mind sharing the night together. Oh, yeah. Sharing the night together. Oh, yeah. Sharing the night. We could bring in the morning, girl, if you wanna go that far. And if tomorrow finds us together right here, the way we are, would you mind sharing the night together? Ooh, yeah. Sharing the night together. Ooh, yeah. Sharing the night. Would you like to dance with me and hold me? You know I wanna be holding you. Oh, yeah. Alright. 'Cause I like feeling like I do when I see eyes, if you're liking it, I'm liking it too. Oh yeah, alright. Like to get to know you better. Is there a place where we can go, where we can be alone together and turn the lights down low and start sharing the night together?
Dr. Hook there. It's time now to talk wood turning. David Hogg caught up with a professional wood turner from the UK that also happens to be blind.
Today we're joined by Chris Fisher, a blind wood turner, and he's here to tell us about his sight loss and his career as a wood turner. Chris, thanks so much for joining us here today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
First, can you tell us a bit about your sight loss, please?
I'll have to transport the listeners back to October 2008. It was a Sunday morning and I woke up one morning severely visually impaired, and it happened as quickly as that. Woke up and there you go, little sight. It was like looking through Vaseline that had been smeared over my eyes. So not much we could have done really that summer. And I didn't feel physically unwell. I was just, you know, what's going on? And we got a very quick appointment at our local optometrist. He said that my retinas were heavily swollen and I needed to go to Manchester Eye Hospital. I went there the following day and they thought, yeah, strange, but it could be early onset of macular degeneration and it could have been an arthritic form of blindness called uveitis. And really, a couple of days after that initial referral, it started going from blurriness to portions of eyesight that had gone black. And that continued to progress. And by the time they did the angiogram, only 4 weeks later, I was totally blind. And the diagnosis was toxoplasmosis, which is quite rare. So that's it in a nutshell. Wow, that was a weird time.
By the timescale of it, you didn't really have an awful lot of time to get your head around it. So did you have a chance to like fully comprehend what happened?
Well, I obviously, at periods like that, you're sort of putting your faith in the medical experts and the machinery is doing what it needs to do. So I didn't really psychologically know what was going on. And, you know, straight away, you're registered blind and then the sensory teams and social workers, etc., get involved with your rehabilitation. So there's a lot to do there and being taught how to do the basics, you know, prepare a simple meal and make a drink and you get your liquid level indicator. And I got my long cane and had training with that. So for the first year, there was a lot going on and I was doing a cookery course for the blind. And yeah, I was just really in shock that first year and my mental state was fine. And then a year after going blind, I mean, holy moly, did my world turn upside down in a very quick and gut-wrenching way. Yeah, I was okay the first year, but then I became very unwell mentally.
Almost takes time for it to sink in, I suppose.
I was still in shock. I was in shock for a year, and our eyesight plays a huge part in everything we do. Absolutely everything we do, your eyesight plays a part in. To have that sense unplugged in such a quick way, it's a lot for the brain to deal with and process. And yeah, it was just shock, you think. So a year after going blind, I was at college and I had a massive panic attack and I was sick and I had to be taken home. And that was the start of 4 years of debilitating, gut-wrenching, panic attacks, hallucinations, insomnia, muscle spasms. And, you know, that's not to say that everybody going through sight loss or blindness will experience those symptoms. They might experience just one or two. It's a very confusing, strange time. But what was really helpful to me was the RNIB counselling service. So I ultimately had 12 sessions of counselling with a chap called Marius. He played such a pivotal part in helping me come to terms and realise, you know, that it wasn't the end. It was just the start of a new journey. And, you know, I began to have, you know, periods of happiness again. Yeah, it was 4 years that I will never want to repeat. But it, in a way, it's defined who I am and where I am and who, you know, and where I'm going.
Moving on now to your wood turning. Was that before or after your sight loss? How did you become involved in that?
Well, I had been blind for about 5-6 years before I started wood turning. So I am self-taught after going blind. The reason I took up wood turning is I love horror films and I love vampire films. And I used to love putting on a great Halloween yard haunt for the kids. I wanted a vampire stake as a Halloween prop. So I was feeling much better mentally now and psychologically, and I wanted to get back to some normality. And I didn't just want to whittle a stick in the garden. You know, I have an engineering background and I thought I can do better than just whittling a stick on the end. So I knew wood turning would be the way forward, but I'd never done it. So I immersed myself in the college that is YouTube. So I listened to 600 hours, we've calculated it at, of wood turning tutorials, and that was helping me assimilate information on machinery, tools and techniques, finishing, shaping, sharpening tools. So I treated it very seriously. It was like going to college for me. Every day for about 5 hours, I'd sit there and fire up the laptop and fire up the screen reading software. And, you know, I was just making all these mental images because I did have a memory map because I was sighted. So I could join a lot of the dots together. Bought a lathe and taught myself just by touch, and I did get my vampire steak.
And just going on there to some of the techniques, what adaptations have you had to make from, say, a sighted person?
As far as the machinery and tools go, I haven't really made any. There's a couple of things that I've got, and the tool rest that you run your tools along. I have got stop ends on the end of my tool rest, so I can use them so I don't fall off the end of the tool rest, which could be a bit disconcerting. I've invented a device that helps me locate and determine the right size for mortises and tenons, which is a way of holding work on the lathe. I've got a talking tape measure. I have apps on my phone. And I've got a pen friend, so I can stick labels on, you know, different coloured stains and finishes, and try to be as independent as I can. You know, you don't really need that much tech to make a big difference. And certainly my talking tape measure, which came from the R&IB shop, and my pen friend, you know, they're really my go-tos, and they're used every day and indispensable.
So, Chris, what would you say is the highlight of your professional woodturning career so far?
Well, there's so many to choose from, but I would say personally it was passing the accreditation and becoming a registered professional turner. So I was being sort of like urged on by some master woodturners that I know in the community, and they were telling me to do it. And I said, I'd love to become the first blind registered professional turner, but am I good enough? And they were saying, yeah, we'll sponsor you. So you need two master wood turners that are registered professionals to sponsor you. So I had my sponsorship, and they said that, yeah, they'd love to come out and assess me. And it was a very intensive assessment. It takes about 2.5 hours. They're checking all of your wood turning, and they're checking your workshop safe, and, you know, you've got all your health and safety and PPE in place. And, you know, it was amazing to do the assessment. And they did say, is there anything we need to know? Because we've never done this before, assess the blind person. So I said, well, just give me some extra time. And if I'm start, stop, feel, that's not indicative of a problem. It just means, you know, I'm trying to build up a mental image. Yeah, that was the assessment. And 3 weeks later, we found out that I'd passed, so I've become the first ever blind person to become a registered professional turner, and I'm entitled to use the letters after my name now. So professionally, I'm Chris Fisher RPT, registered professional turner, and I'm on the database in such illustrious company on there. It's an honour, and it's all part of the Worshipful Company of Turners, which has been going since the 12th century. So it's an honour, and again, if I can do it, anybody else that wants to become a wood turner and they're visually impaired or blind, you know, what's stopping you? You know, nothing at all. You know, nothing's handed to you in life, but the only thing stopping you is you. So, that's probably the highlight.
Have you got any advice for people perhaps recently diagnosed with sight loss who might be going through a hard time, or they want to pick up a hobby similar to how you picked up wood turning? What advice have you got for them?
My advice will be never, ever give up. And, you know, I'm not going to sugarcoat things. Things can be difficult becoming blind or visually impaired. It can be frustrating. It can be sad and lonely, and it can make you angry. But please never, ever give up. And you do not have to do it on your own. Please, you know, if you're having a bad day, talk to someone. The R&IB is there with their counselling service. And you've got the support of hopefully your friends and family, and also some medical professionals. Please don't just let it run around and around in your head. Get help. Don't ever be afraid to ask for help. It's really important. And never give up. You will get it. And there will be good days and bad days. But hopefully soon, you know, the bad days will become less frequent, and you'll come to terms with your new life, and you can crack on. We are all amazing, and we all have this ability to be amazing. So whether or not you want to be a wood turner, or, you know, a potter, get into ceramics, or you want to be an artist, you know, cabinet making, musician, you go for it. You seize that challenge with both hands and embrace that new challenge and this new part of your life, and you will get there. Just remember and keep telling yourself, you know, I am amazing and I can do this. And So what if it takes me 4 days compared to what will take a sight person just a day? Just never give up. Stick with it and you'll get there. And in turn, you will inspire and motivate lots of people around you, like, you know, I do. And that's really the bottom line as to why I do what I do. And, you know, I've gone so public with it, you know, demonstrating all around the country and at shows and being sponsored and working with the BBC on the Money for Nothing show. The bottom line has always been to inspire and motivate people. And hopefully, you know, they'll hear or see me doing something and they go, I'd love to have a go at something like that. And if he can do it, if Chris can do it, what's stopping me? You know, so please attack life with gusto. Yeah, you will certainly have a much better life keeping busy, challenging yourself. And it helps with the mental health as well, because keeping busy, it's great therapy, and working with your hands and being creative. You know, I can attest to how great a therapy that is, keeping your mind focused and giving you something to do and, you know, challenging yourself and pushing that envelope.
Finally, where can our listeners find you online and see some of your work? I believe you're quite big on the old Instagram.
Yeah, I'm at Blindwood Turner on Instagram. So there's a collection of videos and still photos there as well. And I'm on YouTube, the Blindwood Turner. I'm on Facebook, Twitter. Yeah, I'm all over the place. And, you know, it is a very exciting life that I have now. And, you know, in part, you know, it's who I was meant to be, really. And I don't want to change who I am now. But yeah, I'm all over the place. You can find me easily. Just type in the Blindwood Turner into your favorite search engine and I'm sure you'll find where I am.
Fantastic stuff. Well, Chris Fisher, thanks so much for joining us here on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, David. We're slowly drawing to a close on today's happy hour, but we still have time for one more track. Here's Elle King, and our music therapy moment is coming up after.
They never wanna leave. They never wanna leave.
X's and O's by L. King, bringing us to the end of today's show. We had a lovely time keeping you company, but unfortunately, we have to run. If you would like to listen again to any of the interviews featured on today's show, or maybe just catch up on a previous episode, we have a podcast.
Yeah, we do. Just search for RNIB Happy Hour podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Now we're going to let Chris introduce the final track.
And of course, we'll see you next week. Bye.
Bye.
Hi, Chris Wallace here. My choice of song certainly provided me with a lot of musical therapy through the lockdown years and way beyond. The musical Hamilton was released onto Disney Plus in July of 2020, so right at the beginning of lockdown, and it was full of joy and hope and fun and amazing performances. It became the first real shining light in what had been a pretty dark time. The original cast of the show reunited over Zoom a number of times over lockdown to promote the release on Disney Plus, and in doing so, they made those of us who were new to it feel a little bit like part of the Hamilton family. In one of their reunions, they performed Helpless for the Jimmy Fallon show using at-home instruments, including kazoos and pots and pans and even a half-full glass of whiskey. It was enchanting to watch people take utter delight in something they had made, all while being stuck in their own homes like the rest of us. It was like opening a window in a stuffy room and taking a long draw on some fresh air. Here is that song that helped me so much through lockdown, Helpless, from the Broadway musical Hamilton, performed by Philippa Sue and Lin-Manuel Miranda. It's an ode to young love and hope and joy, and it fills me with delight and the kind of happiness that can't help but draw a smile. I hope you enjoy it too.
Change your life.
And by all means, lead the way.
Elizabeth Schuyler, it's a pleasure to meet you.
Schuyler.
My sister. Thank you for all your service.
If it takes fighting a war for us to meet, it will have been worth it.
I'll leave you to it. 1 week later, I'm writing a letter nightly. Now my life gets better every letter that you write me. Laughing at my sister because she wants to form a harem.
I'm just saying, if you really love me, you would share them.
Ha! 2 weeks later, in the stressing, my father stone-faced while you're asking for his blessing. I'm dying inside as you whine and dine, and I'm trying not to cry cause there's nothing that your mind can't do. My father makes his way across the room to you. I panic for a second thinking we're through, but then he shakes your head and says be true, and you turn back to me smiling.
Yeah. I don't have a dollar to my name, an acre of land, a troop to command, a dollop of fame. All I have is my honor, a tolerance for pain, a couple of college credits and my top-notch brain. And say your family brings out a different side of me. Peggy confides in me, Angelica tried to take a bite of me. No stress, my love for you is never in doubt. We'll get a little place in Harlem and we'll figure it out. I've been living without a family since I was a child. My father left, my mother died, I grew up buck wild, but I'll never forget my mother's face, that was real. As long as I'm alive, Eliza, I swear to God you'll never feel so.
I dare with you, I do,
Eliza.
I dare with you, I do.
I never felt so.
You can be a new man.